This event is called Radical Chic? And the title is shamelessly borrowed from an essay written by Tom Wolfe in the early 1970s. Wolfe's original essay was in fact about the gentrification of radical politics and, by extension, the gentrification of street culture. What this talk is aiming to do, I think, is to perform a kind of very small little audit on not just the state of contemporary culture at the moment, but more to the point, how does the state of contemporary culture at the moment affect creative practice, whether that's artisan image making or whether it's the whole business of being an artist? That all sounds kind of vague. I think that another way of looking at it is to, well, there's a few things I'd like to say. It seems to me that over the 20th century, there have come these intervals where people have just had the general feeling that culture is in some kind of a crisis. It's a kind of tick, this, that happens in the culture every so often. Some examples would be, and here's a name you probably never thought you'd hear at the Frieze Art Fair, but in 1939, Malcolm Muggeridge wrote an essay called The 30s, in which he looked back over the preceding decade and said, this is the end of civilization. It's no longer possible to make interesting art. It's all over. If that wasn't enough, at the end of the 1940s, T.S. Eliot wrote a similar essay. I don't know whether he'd read Malcolm Muggeridge's, but Eliot's essay said much the same thing. Well, frankly, the days when you could make interesting art have long gone. The entire rhetoric of culture is debased. There's no point carrying on. We have lived in vain. 1958, Colin Wilson comes along. He says pretty much the same thing at the end of The Outsider and suggests that maybe one way that we can cope with the deteriorating state of culture is to apply ourselves more directly to the inner spiritual life. End of the 1960s, Jonathan Green writes an essay saying, well, the counterculture didn't work, culture's never been as bad as this, and says perhaps it was all just fashion, and we too have lived in vain. I also noticed that at the end of the 1990s, or thereabouts, Blake Morrison popped up in a big essay on the front of The Independent, I think it was, saying, well, this really is it. It's never been as bad as this. Culture in an absolutely, we have lived in vain. There is no point trying to make culture anymore. So there's all these people, you see, about every 10 or 15 years come out with this feeling that culture is in crisis. And yet here we are at the Frieze Art Fair, the biggest art fair of its kind ever organised in the UK. And two more points I'd like to make. It seems to me that, if anything, there's now too much culture. I'm borrowing directly from the distinguished gentleman on my right, Peter York, who came out with a fantastic line, must have been a good 4 years ago, because Peter is always at least 4 years ahead of everybody else. But Peter just said, well, there's too much of everything. And speaking as somebody creeping into their 40s, who frankly is baffled by any art made later than, say, Gilbert and George, it seemed a very good line, that really we're now surrounded by just too much of everything. We've got too many different types of bagged salad, we've got too many sandwiches, too many, ultimately, art galleries, too many people making art, maybe just too many images floating around. That's point number one. Point number two comes from a conversation, name drop here coming, that I had with Quentin Crisp before he died in New York. And Quentin Crisp had been asked to model for Calvin Klein. And he turned up on the day that the advertising shoot was going to happen to be confronted with this enormously elaborate set that they were going to take his photograph on. And Quentin Crisp must have been, God, nearly 90 when this happened. And he took one look at this enormous set with cameras, lights, props, everything else, and simply said, what does it mean? And he was quite surprised to see the following week when these hoardings shot up all over New York, which simply said, Calvin Klein, what does it mean? So this is something else we're going to be looking at, is this idea that is this morning's avant-garde this afternoon's advertising campaign? In other words, is the uptake now from what we used to think of as marginal, serious, radical, cutting-edge culture into the mainstream of advertising, pop videos, etc., etc.? Is it now all so fast that, frankly, we do as well to stop thinking about those kind of distinctions, maybe even stop thinking in terms of art at all? Just, you know, say we're now a post-art culture because there's so much of everything you can't make a distinction anymore. All of this may all come to nothing, but people on this panel are more than qualified than I to have a shot at talking about some of these ideas. So I'm going to introduce you briefly to them. Then they are each going to make a little 10-minute presentation just to get stuff off their chests, really. You are urged to join in at any point you want. Well, not quite any point you want, if you could wait until people have finished their presentations. But we encourage debate here. So going from this side over, on the end is Jan Verwoerd, who is a hugely distinguished writer on art, art critic, curator, professor, has won prizes at it. You can believe anything he says about art. Next to him is Kim Gehrig, who is an art director at the equally hugely distinguished Mother Advertising Agency. And Kim has been responsible for some groundbreaking commercials, notably the famous Schweppes one, which we all saw and enjoyed because it was better than the programs. At the other end is Lucy McKenzie, artist based most of the time in Glasgow and in Eastern Europe, currently has a show on at the Tate. Lucy has got some fascinating ideas about what her role as an artist might comprise these days. Well worth listening to. And to my immediate right, person I can only describe as mentor, guru, probably the cleverest man in the universe, Peter York, who is, amongst other things, the author of Style Wars, Sloan Ranger Handbook, The 80s, and runs one of the biggest management consultancies in the world and rescues children from burning buildings. So we're going to begin with a presentation from Kim Gehrig, and so that will take about 10 minutes. Okay, Kim.
In the context of this talk, it's like, how does a creative person work within advertising? And I work as an art director with a writer, and we basically come up with ads. I guess it's much more frustrating than being an artist a lot of the time in that we work to someone else's brief. So we don't create kind of our own thing. We have a brief or a set of problems from someone about basically how to sell their product more. And then they have all of their ideas of how they think it should be done. And what I think is quite interesting about Mother is it tries not to big up or create a conceit about a product. So if you look at the Super Noodles or Cuppa Soup work, we don't try and make more of a product than what it is. For instance, when Super Noodles came to Mother, they wanted to sell it as a potato substitute for Good Mums, which was kind of ridiculous. And what Mother tries to do is just look to the truth of the product. And with Super Noodles, you have it when you get pissed, basically. It's a really shitty product in a bag, and that's kind of when you eat it. But hopefully what Mother does is try to be quite honest about that, and then provide pieces of entertainment. One question that Michael had asked me to kind of answer was, I guess who my audience is as an art director in advertising, and there's a few audiences. There's one which is our client, which is, you know, marketing people, which is probably the most frustrating bit of the job that I do. And then the scariest bit is the audience is millions of people generally. So when you do something that you're very proud of and you like, you're thrilled that so many people get to see that piece of work. And then other times when you've done a piece of shit that some, you know, it's been messed up along the way and you're so embarrassed that you did, also millions of people see it all the time. So hopefully that's an insight to what I do, and maybe we can talk about some of the stuff later on.
That's great. Thank you very much. Terrific. Next up, Jan, on the end, is going to say a few words. Thank you.
Something that I want to talk about is a little bit more theoretical, and it's about the role model of the cultural entrepreneur. It's something that I got interested in quite some time ago when it was suddenly becoming apparent that not only artists were encouraged to organize their work like entrepreneurs, but also entrepreneurs were presenting themselves to the public as artists or cultural producers. For example, I read in a text by Patricia Bickers in 1995 called The BritPack, the View, Young British Art, The View from Abroad, where she sort of characterized young British art as something which has to do with confrontational humor, but also with an entrepreneurial spirit. Sort of that these were the two characteristics that she pointed out, so that you organize your own art practice, get the collector to come to your exhibition. So that would be the artist as entrepreneur. And on the other hand, I saw an interview with Hans-Olaf Henke, the former president of the German Association of Industries, who said, like, the top managers today are the true avant-garde artists because they are really shaping our culture with their creativity. And so suddenly you realize there's two forces, two factions identifying with this term of the cultural entrepreneur, artists and businessmen alike. So last year in the Kunstverein Munich, we did a symposium about this topic with Maria Lind and Sören Grammel. We invited a number of sociologists and discussed that topic. And so what I'm going to talk about is basically a very rough summary of what that discussion was about. So what is that cultural entrepreneur? I think it is characteristic to this role model that both people who work in the field of business and people in the field of art and culture are encouraged to identify with being a cultural entrepreneur. The key attraction of this model is the suggestion that business people and cultural producers basically are doing the same job. The basic assumption promoted by the model of the cultural entrepreneur is that we live in a post-industrial age where our economy is based on ideas, images, and information. So the raw material of this economy is intelligence, that is, embodied intelligence, the talents of resourceful individuals. So by this definition, persons, or rather personalities, with the ability to produce innovative ideas are portrayed as the avant-garde of a new form of intelligent capitalism. From this point of view, it makes no difference if you are into art or business. If the product you generate is intelligence, you are part of the same game, the creative industry. Obvious manifestations of this cult of the cultural entrepreneur are everywhere. The cultural entrepreneur is a street-style icon. Dressed for success, but with a carefully composed bohemian slackness, combining alternative subcultural dress codes and hairstyles with a display of the official power tools of information capitalism, mobile phones, laptops, or basically anything with a digital interface to show that you're connected. For this new kind of bohemian entrepreneurial chic, it's crucial to exhibit the identity of work and lifestyle. Work is glamorous, it's glamorous to work. So that's the bottom line. Another common monument to intelligent capitalism is the newly built contemporary art space, preferably combined with an experimental bridge construction close by. Lots of millennium bridges everywhere now in Europe. Usually these art spaces are positioned in former industrial areas where structural redevelopment is currently in process. Obvious examples can be found not only in London, but also, for instance, in Bilbao or Newcastle. They even have the same bridge in Newcastle and Bilbao, roughly. So the high modern, high-tech architecture of these art spaces proves to the people in the city that the times are changing, that today monuments are built to those who produce images, ideas, and information. So these art spaces are designed to make people understand the beauty and value of the intelligence our economy is based on. So then next question, of course, would be, what is at stake in this discourse of entrepreneurial culture for the individual cultural producers? Why should it matter to us? And what opportunities are there? I think generally the positive thing about promoting the entrepreneurial attitude among artists is that this campaign might actually be seen to pick up on an emancipatory tradition of self-organization. As such, the model of the cultural entrepreneur can be seen as a critical alternative to the reactionary romantic cliché of the artist as a self-destructive outsider, locked up in his little studio, passively waiting to be discovered and rescued by a curator, gallerist, or collector. So portraying the artist as an entrepreneur actually means to attribute the capacity and responsibility to the artist to become active and get alive. In this sense, it encourages artists to break with the ritual and myth of self-victimization. On the other hand, of course, the identification of the field of cultural production with the world of business is highly problematic. In other words, the concept of a cultural entrepreneur is pure ideology, or false consciousness, if you want, because it dissimulates or obscures the fundamental difference between the ways in which the economy of culture and the world of business work. Contrary to the world of business, the economy of cultural production is only in part based on money. Essentially, it thrives on the symbolic capital of social recognition. As a cultural producer, you work, or let's say, you are expected to work primarily to be recognized as a personality. The public acknowledgement of your contribution to the public is thought to be the true honorary for your work. So the good thing about this symbolic economy is that in most cases at least, it ensures that the credit of your work goes straight to you and not to your superior. So there's your name under the work, under the text, so you somehow get the surplus value of that. The problem is, however, that an economy primarily based on symbolic credits cannot sustain the lives of the people who participate in it. You need money to live. Recognition alone won't do. But it is precisely this problem that the model of the cultural entrepreneur obscures. It suggests that it is possible today to materially sustain your life by producing immaterial goods, regardless of your profession. Once people are led to believe that a media designer, a public relations manager, an artist essentially do the same job, they tacitly expect that they get the same payment, which of course is not true. As a result, you get a number of problems. If the role of the artist is promoted as that of a creative urban professional, then there is no evident reason why the artist should need to be supported by public funds. Like, you would not think of helping out a stockbroker with money to get his job done. Moreover, if artists and cultural producers are expected to share the same lifestyle as any urban professional, of course, that puts stress on them to actually maintain the outward appearance that they do have that lifestyle, even if in reality they don't have the money to sustain that lifestyle. So we're always trying to catch up on that, although no one admits that there's no money, and at least sort of that kitschy modernist idea of the poor artist admits you to say, like, I don't have any money, and that's cool. So that's no longer possible in that model of thinking. Finally, the confusion of a cultural economy of symbolic recognition with a money-based economy has consequences also for other fields of work. It is noticeable that the working conditions of the cultural field are progressively applied also to other jobs in the creative industry or elsewhere. By now, it is no longer just a personal choice to work for recognition and not for money. Self-exploitation has become a norm, a standard. It is taken for granted in most jobs in the creative industry that employees identify themselves with their job and their company like they would identify themselves with a cultural community or a personal creative project. The surplus value of participating in a specific culture or lifestyle of working has become more important than the actual payments. So paradoxically, the progressive fetishization of work as a lifestyle results in a progressive devaluation of work. Just like a musician is expected to accept that he or she pays to play, the cultural entrepreneur is expected to live for work and not to work to make a living. In this sense, the role model of the free creative cultural producer has become an ideological tool to encourage people to work more for less money by suggesting that investing your personality into your work makes you feel as free as an artist would. However, of course, it would be wrong to conclude that all forms of engaged creative production have today been co-opted and corrupted by the ideology of capitalism. Even if our post-industrial economy celebrates the creative individualist as the protagonist of neoliberalism, it does not follow from this that every creative individualist actually is a protagonist or accomplice of neoliberalism. The difference between cultural production and capitalist business have been blurred, but they have not collapsed entirely. On the contrary, I think it is more important than ever to highlight these differences. This certainly can't be done in terms of general definitions of what is culture and what is business. I think that that comes out as nonsense inevitably. Instead, it has to be worked out again and again in relation to specific situations where these limits are. What economies exactly are we working in? Are the conditions of these economies acceptable? Is there enough money in this economy to sustain creativity? Do we actually get the freedom that we are promised in exchange for our investment of personal energies? Do we get a real choice to define our working conditions through our own investments, or are we just led to accept a predefined status quo by the promise of participating in a glamorous culture of self-exploitation? In other words, it becomes important to dissociate the modernist ideal of the autonomous creative individual from the way in which this ideal is put to use under the current conditions of capitalism. The modernist ideal is that existential freedom manifests itself most clearly in the ability to reject the division of labor and create your own life through your own work. Against the backdrop of this philosophy, the pressing question is, how much actual freedom does our lifestyle of creative individualism provide us with? To which degree are we empowered or disempowered by our readiness to work for free? Moreover, when you study the concept of modern individuality, another difference becomes clear. Neoliberalism promotes creative individualism as a good in itself. The avant-gardist discourses of modernism, on the contrary, never simply promoted the concept of the creative individual. Rather, they defined the creative individual in relation to society as one element in a problematic constellation, as something which is not the solution but a problem. Something which is neither a norm nor a secured reality, but rather a project with an unclear outcome. So in continuation with the discourse of modernism, I would think it necessary to criticize the promotional rhetoric of creative individualism, not by discarding the concept of the creative individual as such, but by describing or by redescribing the situation of the creative individual as a problematic social constellation, and by emphasizing that what is at stake in this constellation is the effort or the project to freely define your life through your work.
So that. Wow. Thank you very much. A good moment now to point out that there is a fantastic essay by Jan about Lucy in the current issue of Freeze magazine, I think the one that's doing the rounds here. And in a lot of ways, although Lucy may disagree, I can't actually think of a better preliminary bit of talk to introduce some of the things that Lucy looks at, because I think in a way Lucy as an artist is trying to address a lot of the issues which Jan's just raised in that talk. So if Lucy could talk next, that would be great. Thank you.
Well, I've got some slides, so you put the lights down. Yeah, I'm an artist and I'm based in Glasgow, and I'm going to just show quite a lot of images and discuss some aspects of my work which I feel relate to the topics that we are going to talk about today. Can everyone hear okay? I think that ultimately all responsibility for artists lies on the artists themselves, and in the kind of these overdetermined cultural times, nothing's dead and nothing is over. It's just changed, and there's different things you have to do to kind of sidestep being either an unwitting or an unwilling victim in this kind of incredible overdetermination. One strategy is to work collaboratively. Just for as long as I've been making work, I've always being quite honest to the fact that I come out of a support system of a kind of grassroots network of artists and musicians and discourse, and I've never wanted to kind of extract myself from that. To work collaboratively means you have a kind of certain different responsibility to the work. You come out of yourself a bit. It's not you. It's a collective force. And I work closely with an artist from Poland called Paulina Aloska. This slide is a shot of a mural that we did a couple of years ago on the side of the Solidarity shipyard in Gdansk. I've also worked with a fellow Scot called Keith Farquhar, and together we've made work, and we've worked as curators. working as a, I mean, in, at this point when the institution, the role of the institution is so tightly branded, and the role of the curator and this kind of cultural entrepreneur is so elevated, I think it's basically your obligation as an artist to exploit that certain freedom that you're given as an artist to break into these kind of bureaucratic frameworks in the art world. So working as a curator, I've had a lot of freedom to be just a bit stranger than I think, or unless accountable to a kind of, you can just be weird. People indulge you more if you're an artist, and I've been able to use the opportunity of curating to just drag my friends along with me and show the work of people that I respect and talk about ideas which I think have been under-discussed. This was a show we did at the Transmission Gallery, and we gave it a kind of facelift. We turned it into an Irish pub. We also, a couple of years ago, did a stand at the Glasgow Art Fair. I mean, the appreciation of art in Scotland is impoverished, to say the least. And the Glasgow Art Fair has it's very, very different from this. It's either stands with pictures of dogs and flowers, or the kind of young, cool galleries like the Transmission and the Modern Institute and these kind of young people. And so we basically pretended to be a gallery, and we did a stand which looked like an old stand but was actually a kind of artist project. But it wasn't a very nice experience. It's not, I couldn't sell anything to anyone, so. Last year I curated a show in Braunschweig called The Best Book About Pessimism I Ever Read, and it included a lot of Scottish artists and just a kind of informal network of friends, artists that I'm close to and care about a lot. And one presentation was this writer from Glasgow, Alistair Gray. He's more famous as a writer, but he's an artist as well. And he just never shows anywhere, so it was a great opportunity to get to know my heroes. In Glasgow, I'm part of an artist studio. The last few years we've organised over about a month a series of evenings called the Flourish Nights, and they're just a bit of a free-for-all. There's music and film and performance, and I get funding from the Scottish Arts Council, just a bit of money to do them, but it's incredibly important to me that they're free to get into. And because I apply as an individual, saying that it's a kind of extension of my practice, I can again have that freedom to basically do what I want and not be accountable in the same way as a kind of as a curator or a gallerist. And it's incredibly the freedom when you don't have to have a marketing office, PR, advertising. It's great. And but then because it's open, we have to be responsible for that. And we've had the place set on fire and different things like that. It can be a bit, free for all. And I make all the kind of oblique advertising for the evenings myself. I think over the last while my work has moved away from easel painting into things like organising projects and murals, and it's all become kind of embedded in a kind of functionalism. And so to make the advertising for these nights is just as important piece of my work as any exhibition anywhere. This is just some shots of the evenings. In May this year, myself and my collaborator did a project with the Foundation Foxhall in Warsaw, and it was called Nova Popularna, and we took over a space, a kind of old gallery, for a month, and we turned it into an illegal bar. We made the murals ourselves, designed the interior, made the furniture, and we had homemade moonshine vodka. I mean, it was we absolutely managed to keep branding to a minimum. We had our own alcohol. So the only brands we had in the bar was Kim cigarettes for sale and a beer called Zhivich, both chosen for their kind of aesthetic girlishness, because we really wanted to do a very kind of feminine environment. Yeah, everything got completely graffitied and worn away. Instead of depicting some kind of cliche of a bohemia we realized after a while that we were actually living this kind of tableau of a certain kind of bohemia or sort of modernism, which is pre-punk and pre-situationist. We were looking a lot at the post-impressionist paintings of people like Toulouse-Lautrec. And we realized that we wanted to kind of embody the women that were depicted in these paintings. We had quite a refined clientele, as you can see. It was really difficult, you know. I've never worked in a bar before. We had to clean up the vomit and the broken glass. We had to be diplomatic with drunk people and bar boers and the police. And this is the exhibition I've got on at the Tate at the moment. It's called MMIV, which means to 2004. And because of so much of what I've been doing has been inside this kind of social situation, to then approach doing a solo show somewhere as big as the Tate, it's quite difficult to know how you can manage this, the incongruousness between these two kind of worlds. And it's with this, with the Tate as such a brand, you know, the syndication of the brand of the Tate to Condé Nast for their magazine. I just wanted to do something which asserted my own individuality within the Tate itself, and I thought one way to do that would be maybe to somehow have someone else's logo on the promotional material that would be, that I could have sort of bigger than the taste to slightly undermine that kind of branding. And so through the experience of being in Warsaw, doing the bar, meeting a lot of women and seeing the kind of reality of making work and being a young female artist or a young woman there, I decided to make the show for charity. It's this group La Strada, and they're a support network for women who've been victims of trafficking. In the last 10 years, with the collapse of communism, Eastern Europe's turned into a kind of reserve labour force for the West. And one outcome of that is the expansion of the sex industry and the huge influx of women into places like Britain. When I was, a few years ago, I had my own, a very brief and sheltered and enjoyable brush with the sex industry as a pornographic model. So I have not irrational, but a real over-identification with these women who are smart and just through the lack of opportunities are forced into these horrific working conditions. And then the idea of charity, because so much art is supposed to be socially engaged, but it always stops at a certain point. The way with the bar, it absolutely had to function. It wasn't alluding to being a social space, it was a social space. And with charity in Britain, it's such a kind of Dickensian construct, it's such an old-fashioned way of thinking about being socially responsible. And then the culture in Britain of the sort of celebritisation or the tying of charity to celebrity. Brian Eno and Damien Hirst collaborating on War Child, this kind of thing. It's just so in the kind of grey area of being kind of, it's very unfashionable. And I thought I could use that as a way to kind of wrestle with this position in an institution. So all the work in the show was for sale, and the collector writes a cheque for directly to the charity. This was a year planner that I designed for the show, and it's an empty year planner for next year, partly made so that I could give them to my friends to encourage them to get their shit together and to work hard and be organised, but also to kind of illustrate the melancholy of work. Work isn't glamorous, work is boring. And to be a kind of female artist in the Tate, to highlight the difference in the working life between different sections of society, even within London, you know, Soho isn't very far away. And then I did some other bullshitty pictures to put in the space as well to kind of make it look like an exhibition. And that's it. I've just been thinking about what's already been mentioned, and this idea that information and intelligence is this kind of economy now. I'm wondering if integrity, this will be the new kind of currency, and integrity will be another kind of fetishized commodity, because certainly in my practice I've just always tried to keep just to be honest to the, and not be extracted from some kind of scene to symbolize that scene and be told to be and be exceptional, but to absolutely stay within the kind of peer group that I'm part of and that makes the work that I make. And that's it for just now, I think.
And Peter.
Right. Well, good afternoon, art lovers of all nations. Welcome to Britain. I hope you're going to have a lovely time, and especially I hope you're going to buy something. Because remember, buying art is your right now. As you move up the hierarchy of rights in a civilized democratic society, your right is to buy art. And the important thing about art, when you buy art, it redeems you. It washes all your sins away. So think about that. It's very important. Don't go home without a picture. Ideally, buy it from a British dealer. But you must observe your own sin. Now, I'm going to speak very, very slowly, very clearly, very loudly, for the benefit of people who have English as a second language. Now, I should tell you, I have walked on the wild side. Yes? Do read, wild side, yes, good. I've strolled along the towpath to another part of the Black Forest in my time. And back in the late 70s and the early 80s, I used to think about my artist friends in a very wonderful, patronizing and condescending way, which is as it should be. I thought of them as very other. And I thought that everything about them, their language, when they say making art, you thought, making art. Their preoccupations, their references, art within art, the painted word length stuff and all that. And what I especially loved about them, what I really treasured, was what they didn't know. My artist friends, what made it such a treat to go into their houses and flats in the poor part of town, was the delicious fact that there were a lot of things they simply didn't know anything about, how the world worked, about business or government or any of that. It was just lovely, saying these lovely Barlam things. So, from my point of view, they were entertainment. They were a little, I went and saw them, it was a little holiday to go and see them. And because they had no money, they'd always run something up for me, a knock-off of a famous painting or something, maybe something like that. They were really useful. And then, in the early 80s, suddenly it all changed. An artist I knew rang me and said he wondered if any of my clients, because I'm a marketing speak kind of person, if any of my clients would like to sponsor his new show, because it was in an upmarket central London gallery, and the type of audience it would attract would be very attractive, young, well-off people, very suitable for a nice sponsor with a nice upmarket brand. And at that point, I realised what they were talking about, what would later be called yuppies. And I realised then they'd crossed to my side of the road and they'd never go back again. Now, I've been bi ever since I can remember. I was bilingual, English and marketing speak, from the age of about 14. I could speak marketing speak when other people couldn't speak it, when it was regarded as a very voodoo language. And in my first grown-up job, was in a sort of marketing speak business. And back then, when I came home and went out with my friends, who were normal middle-class people doing decent jobs, when I was journalists or traditional professions, and this stuff would tumble out, they would say, oh, come on, talk English. Because they thought it was disgusting and a sort of dignified illiteracy. I mean, now, that's all changed. And that's changed. Well, I think I felt it had changed when I heard a Church of England clergyman refer to another Church of England clergyman's flock as being very upmarket and in a BMW kind of area, if you know what I mean. And then I knew that had happened too. Everybody had got my language. Just like that. My voodoo language, the language that says perception is all. Words like positioning and segmentation, and above all, the language of brand, was happily being used practically everywhere. Now, most post-war people had, I would say, by now had taken it on board, and for people born after 1960, I think that's quite a crucial point, it comes naturally. So if you think about the absorption of art into marketing and marketing into art, you have to see it as a series of historical layers which apply to historical cohorts of people. And with each successive cohort, people get a bigger cultural repertoire. It may be, you know, less deeply experienced or whatever, but they get a deeper cultural repertoire because there's more about to experience and to buy, and there's more ways of buying it in shops and in media. So that the kind of upper middle class children who traditionally were given a diet of what was called highbrow arts, as we go through each decade after the war, successively got more and more of what people called the popular arts, in a rather condescending way. And the time came when everyone, every child that in England would have a nanny, also got gangster rap. And there was no stopping it. Now, a long time ago, I used to talk about myself as a brand. It was a lovely thing to do. And particularly when I thought I could get a rise, you remember, when I thought I could annoy somebody who came from a traditional high culture position. And it always worked. You know, this is a bit complete. I especially enjoyed talking about sacred institutions like the monarchy or Oxbridge or the health service as brands. And people would say, how can you? That's, you know, this ghastly, shallow way of talking. Well, now the joke's on me, because practically all those institutions have had the brand consultants in to do them over. Giving them a logo, a consumer service charter, and all the rest. It's happened. And all the great institutions now use the language of business to describe what they do. The health service and the BBC, anyway, very, very important British institutions, now have recently used the language of the internal market to describe that, what they do. Much mocked, but that's how they organise themselves. Everything, I should say, is market research now. There's an enormous knowingness in the presentation of practically everything. And the people who do the most market research are the people who claim they don't do any. People who say, oh, we're passionate about this, or fanatical about that, and have ads showing they're obsessive people, the sort of Ben and Jerry's of life. Those are the people who do all the market research. We know that. So these people may get it wrong sometimes, the big corporation, the government department, the arts institution, but they will have thought about it very hard, how it, an initiative, a communication, they will have thought about how it will play with its various audience segments. And that is true of everything from an art gallery to an institution of government to a PLC. And they'll all have used professional help. You know, there is not a person, there is no senior civil servant with a public-facing role who hasn't had media training. Now, and more fundamentally, everyone believes everywhere that they have a customer for everything. The language is the language of customers. And that the customer is king. Those are the precepts of marketing. That means you must know your audience. Very, very well. Indeed, you must segment it very, very accurately in more and more sophisticated ways. Ways that rely on understanding what's in people's heads as well as what they do. Now, you need to know who people want to be before you can sell them anything accurately. And you have to make sure your brand, and your brand can be a cultural institution or work, delivers the benefits, as they say, the emotional benefits. Everyone uses that language now. Marketing is marvellous stuff, I tell you. Now, if you add to that, I'm just trying to throw in some little elements that provide the infrastructure. If you add to that an increasingly complex kind of social hierarchy in the world now, which is made up of what Tom Wolfe, who is always right, was talking, describing in the 60s and 70s as status counting, status spheres, where instead of there being an established hierarchy for all time, people lived in a continuous state of being scored for hotness. And that hotness included money and personal style and degree of celebrity and things like that, as well as, well, it helped to be king, it helped to be very rich in a melon kind of way, but nonetheless you could achieve equivalent status by scoring high on the other things. It's not a proper Marxist view of society, but it's a very interesting one, and it's increasingly right, certainly in terms of what people want for themselves and how they see themselves. You might call it false consciousness. People score themselves in terms of factors different from traditional class factors. Now, new thought. Everyone says Warhol anticipated celebrity culture, but he did actually much more than that. What he did was push it along in a very, very considerable way. He made celebrities just to see if he could. And of course they were alternative celebrities and silly, but that proved his point to a very great degree. You know, all those late 60s transvestites proved his point that he could make something out of these people he picked up in the street, very literally. And not only did he do that, when he started Interview, he mixed high culture and very low people to tremendous effect, and in the pages of Interview they were equivalent. So you would have Andy interviewing a major serious gallery grade artist, and interviewing a Latino dancer, and they were the same, because once they were in the redeeming space of Andy's pages, they were exactly the same sorts of people. Now, Andy also used to talk about art business art, very loudly, very conspicuously, and he was right, of course, and i.e. cultural entrepreneurs. I think art business art is a better word than cultural entrepreneurs, frankly. Now, equally, and I'll come back to it, now all kinds of businesses aspire to the condition of art, aspire to the condition of creativity. But when Andy did his diary for Vogue, in this American Vogue, in the early 70s, I think it was, quite unlike other people who would say, oh, I did this, I had this big thought, I met these important people. He said, who paid for what, every tab, and how much? And that was right. Now, new technologies, new structures mean you can co-opt a culture, or a mood, or an aesthetic in about a nanosecond. Take it from me, you can. Those people do it all the time. That's their job. But it's wrong to think that that is an entirely new phenomenon. It's been going on for 35 years, I would say now. And if you look at the brilliant Thomas Frank, I mean, who knows Thomas Frank, a really brilliant cultural analyst, and his analysis of how American advertising didn't just co-opt the counterculture during the 60s, it helped invent it. It pushed it along. recognizing that what people called the counterculture created a set of conditions for more, for braver consumers. The counterculture created the set of conditions, I would humbly suggest, dear audience, that made you into art mavens. It created the market for art. Got a house, got a car, got a holiday, get some art. All that was being done by American corporations pushing along the counterculture way back when. I would suggest that there lie the roots of the equivalent of everything with everything else. That's enough for now.
Okay, now to some extent our panel are the victims of their own excellence, because it's now 28 minutes past 3 and the people from Frieze, I think, are expecting us to leave at 3:30. And so wither the discussion. One thing I was thinking was, if somebody in charge can tell me how long we've actually got before we really do have to leave, that would help.
Who's in charge?
You're in charge. How long have we got? 4:00. Oh, well, there you are.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay, right, some rounding up thoughts. It's almost impossible to generalize about the 4 different perspectives we've heard on this subject so far. But one thing that seems to sort of be vaguely wafting around in my mind, a point that Jan made in his excellent presentation where he said top managers are now the true avant-garde artists, that kind of lodged in. Also, what Lucy was saying about how you have to kind of almost strategize to avoid being commodified before you've even started as regards being an artist. Then, stirring into this mix what Kim and Peter had to say, I wonder whether, from my point of view anyway, I'm coming back to another line of Tom Wolfe's, which was way back, I think, in 1975. He wrote an article called Roy Lichtenstein versus Chester Himes, in which he suggested that artisan image making, artisan culture, had now become more sophisticated than the visual arts, as in contemporary art, at expressing the modern world. That basically the job that artists used to do was now being done far more effectively by people working in advertising, people working in the popular media, who had A, more technical know-how, and B, were just as aware of all the kind of strange little crinkles and folds in our subjectivity that we have often looked to artists to investigate. Now, obviously, I'm deliberately taking an exaggerated position and do not want to be nailed onto this one, but just as a way of sort of starting a bit of a discussion off a hot spot, and it seems to be something which unites all 4 speakers, I wonder if maybe Kim, I could start by... If I'm going to begin by asking Kim, to what extent advertising agencies or people working in her art direction side of it look to contemporary art for any of their research or inspiration?
That's a fair question. A lot, I guess, but I don't think it's just art. I think in advertising you end up being aware of absolutely everything going on, whether it be a television program, a radio show, an exhibition. Weirdly, I think a lot of advertising people aren't that aware of art. You know, that some are, depending on who you talk to, some are not so aware. Obviously, with our Shreps campaign, we worked with an artist on that, which is a very direct kind of thing. You know, promos, I think everything influences advertising as much as it influences other things as well. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Do you, sort of when you're making a commercial like that, are you having to sort of presuppose there's a tremendous sophistication these days in consumers, that they really know how to read an image, from 100 yards away.
Yeah, I think I personally underestimate that sometimes. Sometimes when other teams in the agency are working on things and I'm like, that's a bit obscure. People aren't going to get that. Like the Super Noodles ad that was first, a team, Jan and Luke, made that. And when they wrote it, I was like, oh, that, no one's going to understand what's going on. And then they do, and people love it. And I think people are more sophisticated because they've seen so much stuff. And as I said, I often don't realise that when making stuff. Sometimes we make stuff too simple, I think.
Lucy, this is what I wanted to ask you, that given sort of like what we've all been talking about this afternoon, have you found that you're almost in a position where you're having to kind of de-invent all those ideas of professionalism that artists have sort of accrued around themselves, the stuff that Peter was talking about a little earlier? Because what fascinates me about what you do is that you seem as interested in the right to fail as the right to succeed, and that's what seems to give what you do a kind of independence of sorts. Is that something that you're consciously working with?
Yeah, I think with I think about what makes a good exhibition for me is it's not necessarily about what's on the wall, but it's about a kind of mood that comes off the work. And if part of that that sense you get from a piece of work is that the artist is tired or bored or vulnerable, that is just as, that can be what's great about it. And I'm just thinking about what about Kim's position, and I'm thinking about one instance in particular. There's an album called the Langley School Choir, and it's a bunch of school kids singing like David Bowie songs and things. And there was an article about it in Freeze magazine. And then within maybe 3 months, there was an advert on TV with a kind of kids choir. It was a car advert. But what I'm interested in culture, I'm interested when things get drained of that kind of kudos of being special or new or interesting. I like things have, the quality I look for in things is when they've strayed into being redundant. That's the gold dust for me, and it's about that transformation of something into something else. And the way, especially from having a lot of experience of working in Eastern Europe, you can see almost to the month how much mainstream art and youth culture is sort of lagging behind the West, as well as being a completely interesting culture in its own right. And it's that kind of chemical reaction is what I find exciting.
So do you almost take for granted, as the sort of conditions in which you're working, that you have to kind of allow the rest of the culture to sort of drain its kind of lifestyle qualifications, that you're waiting for things to cease being agents for other people's messages?
Yeah. And also because Glasgow is a cosmopolitan town, but it's nothing like living in London, and it's not even like being in Manchester or one of these other kind of big cities in Britain. It really feels separate, and it's always looked to Europe. But if you know, just down that road of trying to be interesting or stylish or ahead of the game, you're lost. It's just not. If once you get that out of the way, there's lots of room to play around.
And last question I wanted to ask you is, for your generation of artists, do you think that it was quite particularly in Glasgow, which has such a strong local history, I mean recent local history, was there this sense, I mean I heard like with Jim Lambie's work that there was already a phrase for graduate shows called Lammerbees, where people were sort of, you know, the guy had barely been out of college himself a year, and people were doing it. How do you think artists of your generation and younger are going to get round this idea of walking straight in between a pair of inverted commas? It's like the moment they do something. Because one of the things Jan said, which I thought was fascinating, was about the old modernist idea of the artist suffering in the garret. And I'm rather for all bringing back suffering in garrets, personally. I think, you know, it wouldn't be amiss. Do you think that that's the route that people will go down?
Well, things have changed in Glasgow because there are ways out of the city. There's and in Scotland in general, there's now commercial galleries opening up, and that creates a certain standard in the art schools. So as you say, you see a lot of work which panders to a certain aesthetic, which is being promoted as a kind of contemporary Scottish position. And for myself personally, I found my own ways out of Glasgow. I've formed friendships with people from all over the place, and in London, and in Poland, and Germany. And it's just, there are ways to do it if you just don't allow yourself to be kind of to listen to the hype, I guess. With Glasgow, there's very easy ways of putting it. And I mean, you wrote a piece for the Tate magazine, which is a very nice piece of writing, and then the illustrations for the piece were all just photographs of groovy artists hanging out at art openings looking cool, which just didn't relate to the text at all.
I mean, there we've got a bit of an object lesson, because the essay was written for Condé Nast, and the moment it got Condé Nasted, I was rung up by the very nice editor of the thing, who said what we need to do is to find the Scottish Johnny Shan kid to illustrate it. And once you've done that, you've immediately sort of basically written another text alongside it, which, as Lucy says, with lots of people looking funky in bars and things like that. I just wanted to ask, it's so weird trying to talk to people like this. It's kind of. I wanted to ask Jan, I was really interested about what you were saying about the discrepancy between the new type of artist as entrepreneur, the very kind of brand aware, ideologically positioned contemporary creative, and the old modernist model of, as you say, the suffering in garrets and things like that. One of the things, do you feel that one result of this idea of a kind of a surfeit of image making, the bleeding between, as Peter was saying, business speak and art speak and stuff like that, is going to be sort of a very positive sort of espousal of what would have been thought of as reactionary values 5 years ago? I.e. atelier skills, or, you know, sort of being very sort of interested maybe in single disciplines rather than mixed disciplines, and almost kind of a very high romantic idea.
Yeah, I would basically just say that the very moment when the economy becomes culturalized, or when the economy or the economic discourse starts to borrow phrases from the cultural discourse, that can be an opportunity, in the sense that suddenly we as cultural producers or as artists or critics are suddenly sort of taken along on with this language into an area of society where very crucial issues are being formulated. So then art can become a ground where these issues can be contested again, where you can actually ask, like, but if you're promoting individualism in the name of art and freedom, so then what is that individualism? And this is the moment where I suppose then art discourse can become political, in a sense, because it can work with this politics of representation and means, of course, Lucy, as you have said, there's possibilities of working collaboratively to suggest a practical alternative to individualism. But there's also a way to comment on the fantasies and ideas of the individual versus the collective, I think, in the work. And I think this is also something you're doing, like to use painting, like maybe Kippenberger did, as a form to formulate statements, to give commentaries, to ironize, but also to try out ideas of, as you said, like you use the most drained material you get from culture, like dead ciphers of individualism and dead ciphers of the collective, like Soviet socialist realist stuff, and then you just try it out and then show it to people, like, is that what you believe an individual is today, or is that the collective? These ideas, and it's something that I also find in the work of Johanna Billing that has been shown here yesterday, because I think Johanna is also talking a lot about this question of do we still have a concept of solidarity? I don't have any idea of solidarity, because I'm just trained in this kind of individualist mindset. But from that point to start, say, like, yeah, what? How could that look like? And then to make a film with all these eccentrics who get together in this very cheesy "We Are the World" kind of video thing, but suddenly you make it look like a possible reality. You point towards the possibility of solidarity by showing possible solidarity, and I like this kind of discourse, so that you don't have to go outside art, but art can be a ground where these key issues of our society's philosophy can be discussed in various ways. But does that sound too optimistic? I don't know.
That sounds remarkably refreshing. Sorry, did you want to respond at all to that? Mm. I mean, it's odd, just coming off what Jan's just said. A favourite quotation of mine, which rolled around in my mind throughout most of the latter half of the 1990s, was something I found in the school kids issue of a magazine called Oz, which was probably the most notorious of the British underground newspapers in the late 1960s. The school kids issue resulted in a trial for obscenity in which some of the editors of the magazine were jailed. But there was a line in it, and it seems to tie up a lot of what we're talking about here. And the only thing I know about its author was that he was a teenager from Reading, and he was anonymous. But what he said, if memory serves, was along the lines of, the media's got us taped. We haven't infiltrated them. They've infiltrated us. Now the revolution's just a groovy way to sell things. And that seemed incredibly prophetic, that this was somebody writing in 1970, sort of having the acuity to see that all those ideas of individualism or counterculture or otherness had already been co-opted by corporations and by big networks in order to sell the idea of individuality back to us. And I think that that impacts directly onto people trying to work in the creative fields at the moment. So one of the things I wanted to ask Peter was, many years ago when you wrote your essay Them, which I think was in 1976, you identified an entire class of what you could call street aesthetes, for whom ideas, reference points, cultural reference points, were translated with absolute sort of minute detail into personal style. What do you think has changed in the 26 years since you wrote that essay? I mean, is it now a situation that the thems basically have won, that they're the new establishment? And does that mean, sort of by the same token, that to still talk about the margins of culture, which astonishes me, it's a phrase I still hear, the margins of culture, just really doesn't exist anymore anyway?
No. For everyone else's benefit, was an essay about a very visible group of London artists who all knew each other and who believed in individual style and publicity. And they weren't, for the most part, very good artists, but they were entertaining and they loved publicity. And in that sense, they were pioneers. And yes, they have won, because of course now artists know about the value of publicity, know about marketing in their mother's milk. I think they must be taught it in art schools. But of course there is increasing. There are a kind of business art business kinds of courses in major art schools now, which didn't exist before. And there are courses about how to manage stuff in relation to the arts. One thing I wanted to say, which is connected but not obviously, that in the late 80s, all sorts of people in government and in business were immensely influenced by the idea that the arts had huge economic impact. And in this country, when this present government came in, they believed that the quote-unquote creative industries, and that's a very interesting pairing, it was an official pairing in British government parlance, and there was a committee, there was a creative industries task force and a committee, and what they believed was that the nation could be redeemed economically through the arts, that our wonderful advertising people and our lovely little young British artists and our famous brand name architects could actually make up for our declining basic industries and the fact that we hadn't got a share in the important industries of the world, like IT or investment banking, in our own right. And they really believed that. And they believed that until the Millennium Dome. was the Millennium Dome with a very large structure, which was intended to fulfill a variety of functions, one of which was to say something about Britain to the world, a bit of national communication. Another of which was to socially engineer the derelict area on around the dome. And the other was to teach people how to be good, because inside it was very, very instructional. And on New Year's Day 2000, all that Creative Industries thinking vanished, because they opened the dome, and like a conceptual piece, there was nothing there. There was nothing that anybody liked. But up until then, there was a very, very important book called The Economic Impact of the Arts, which looked at the impact of the arts on gentrification, the gentrification of areas. Look at Hoxton. I'm not sure you all have. You know that there are 8,000 art galleries in Hoxton. Well, nearly. It's the native industry in Hoxton, opening art galleries. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I've answered your question.
In the affirmative. Okay.
Can I maybe add just one last short comment? I think it's important to contest these ideologies about the creative industries in the field of culture. I think this is one necessary task, and I think something that we can be capable of. And being co-opted by this ideological discourse is always a way of being pushed onto the center stage with this discourse, so that actually puts you in a position to speak about it. So that's one thing, but the other thing is also to speak about the conditions of work in a way, because we see that it's not with the culturalization of the economy, the conditions of work are changing everywhere, that people are somehow expected to work for free and to invest more, and that suddenly the discourse that we are almost always tacitly accepting, that we work for ourselves but not for the money, suddenly becomes a social norm. And that's another field where the question is, how can we comment about that? Of course, in the art field, in the culture, as cultural critics, you can do ideology critique about symbols of gentrification, but how can we actually speak about the conditions of our work, which are becoming the conditions of work in society? Like, something that I always found very convincing is the line in a song by Liz Phair, where she goes, where the chorus goes, it's nice to be liked, but it's better by far to get paid. I like that as a formula, and maybe it should be interesting to put out more of these formulas to make people aware of what kind of working conditions we're now buying into.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think increasingly there's this sense that... Actually, no, I'm not going to talk about that, because there's 10 minutes and we're very anxious to hear from you. So does anybody have any questions for any individual member or all of us? Or anything, do just raise a hand. Yeah, there's a woman at the...
Is that on?
Yeah,
I'd just like to, first of all, say that I'm really, really glad that we had this debate, because I've kind of been here for a few days and been quite shocked at how absolutely absent the kind of work that Lucy's talking about and the kind of work that I'm aware is going on all around London and other capital cities, including work in squatted galleries and work in, which is really trying desperately to stay out of the drive and the push back into the capitalist system. I'm really glad we've had it. But can I just ask, I think some of it has emerged, but whether or not maybe Lucy and Kim as kind of almost, don't want to put you in opposition, but whether you think it's a good thing that artists are finally totally becoming involved in the kind of flow of life by getting completely co-opted into capital by marketing, because basically if you don't join marketing, they're going to nick your ideas anyway. And if you think that's a good thing, because maybe actually it makes us really just be the same as everybody else, or if there is something that we're actually going to lose if being an artist is nothing more than being another part of this capital industry. Is there a space we should still be fighting for outside of that capital industry?
It's really good. Do you want to have a...
Well, I think I was just wondering if the whole basis of this discussion is on a kind of supposition that the flow of information is good. Is a position in the avant-garde, the actual blocking of information, saying no about this kind of incredible transaction all the time.
One moment. Kim, did you want to say?
Because personally, I think I agree with you in a sense about, I personally respect and prefer artists that don't get caught up in the commercial world as much. I don't know why that is, but I just, you know, I admire that and I respect that, and I find that significantly more inspiring than the ones that do. And I don't know what that means as a person in advertising, and when having worked with artists within advertising, I guess it's quite odd, and it is an interesting experience when that happens. But sometimes I don't understand artists' motivation to work in that field. You know, I work in that field and don't, you know, when I'm working within advertising, I'm not pretending I'm doing anything else than that. Whereas when artists kind of delve into that, sometimes I get confused about what's going on. You know, that.
Jan, do you want
to? Yeah, the thing that I would have to say is that, of course, I think alternative spaces are essential if they support production in a way, if they offer alternative conditions of production and allow people to do something, and I think it's crucial. What I dislike about some concepts of alternative spaces, that it's something that you can find in Germany a lot, is this idea that the social context becomes the guarantee for you that you're on the right side. That as long as you're alternative and everybody just comes together, nobody produces anything, but it's a ritual of reinsurance that we are on the right side, we're alternative, and nothing comes out of it. It's just a continuous maintenance of this mini society where everything is just about producing empty legitimation that you are not part of that game. And I find that incredibly self-indulgent and problematic. So sometimes I feel that it's much more problematic to enter into the game and play with that game and see whether you end up on top or at the bottom, because then there's something really at stake if you enter into this.
And from now,
is that clear?
From my experience away from the projects that I've initiated myself, the most freedom I've had in the kind of art world is within commercial galleries.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky that I work with extremely sympathetic people. The most problems I've ever had has been with institutions, and being just a tiny fragment in the whole process of institutions, and also being part of things like the Beck's Futures and the British Art Show, which, when you're being used to illustrate a kind of idea of being a young artist.
Mm. 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 I think that also, there's this common belief that social contexts which have nothing to do with money, that they are unhierarchical, and this is just not true. Because usually, on the contrary, money tends to objectify, in a way, your contributions. So it's not just on a subjective level of evaluation. And so sometimes these alternative economies where there's no money to objectify what you do, mm-hmm, tend to be very, very hierarchical and
very
almost
ambitious.
Incredibly
ambitious people involved in state-funded projects.
Yeah.
So,
Peter, did you want
to? No, I just to quote Quentin Crisp again, who always said on a regular basis, and that had a moral drive behind it, because Quentin Crisp was a moralist in his way. He said, whatever is done for money is sacred. And that's a very good little poker work motto for artistic people, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think we are getting signalled out to finish now. So thank you. Well, most of all, thank you to Lucy and Peter and Kim and Jan, who I think have been really interesting. Thank you. Thank you all very much for coming.